My next guest is inarguably a comedy legend. You may know him from some of his recent work, like in the movies Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, or classics like The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. Of course, he created The Dick Van Dyke Show and appeared on dozens of other shows, including even as recently as earlier this year when he was on Two and a Half Men as a guest star. He has won 9 Emmys. He's been nominated for 6 others. He was honored for lifetime achievement by the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, the TV Critics Association, the Emmys Hall of Fame, the TV Hall of Fame, the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. It is always a pleasure to talk to Carl Reiner. Welcome back to the show.
Paul, how are you?
I'm doing just fine.
You made me feel so tired. by the way, you know, it's so funny. This reminds me of my mother used to do this. You know, when I'd do the show of shows, and I'd say, how'd you like it, Ma? She says, they didn't give you enough to do. And I thought of my mother. If you had said 9 Emmys, she would say 12 Emmys. 12 Emmys. You got 12 Emmys. Like a show there on a shelf.
I should also get in the big plug, which is that you have a new memoir called I Just Remembered. Now, you and I last talked about a year ago when your previous memoir, I Remember Me, came out. And in reading the new one, it reminded me of the days when I get off the air, I get in my car, I drive home, and on the drive home, I say to myself, ah, you should have said that.
Of course. Everybody has that. And I think that's why this resonates with people. They know exactly what I'm talking about. You know something? I call this one I Just Remembered. And I actually walked around the block every day, and something popped in my head. And the day after the book was published, I said, oh, my God, why didn't I put that in? So I wrote the book, I Just Remembered. Now I've got 40 pages of a book called I Had Almost Forgotten What I Had Just Remembered. I've got 4 more stories, 5 more stories that if you keep living, you keep remembering.
Yeah, in fact, in this book, you wrote a last chapter and then decided, no, wait, I have other things. I just remembered this and that and the other thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I invoked Columbo, who, by the way, that's a show that every time the rerun goes on, I tape it, and I go to sleep watching Peter Falk, just an extraordinary actor, doing, just one more thing, one more thing. And the book occurs to me that, hey, one more thing, one more thing.
Now, you do have a remarkable memory about all of the things that have gone on in your amazing life, but I wonder how much of it you have to double-check yourself, because I see in the book there's pictures of you sitting at your computer as you're writing, and I wonder how often do you say, I better Google that.
Oh, I've done it in a few places, and 2 of them were very important to me. One was the origin of Jeopardy, and I remember Julianne Griffin, Merv's former wife, was a very dear friend of ours. We spent an awful lot of time with her. I just loved her. And I remember the story of how she came up with the idea for Jeopardy. While he was looking for shows to do, she suggested this show, and the way she suggested it, he didn't know what she was talking about. She says, "Oh, there was a scandal at the time, giving answers to the contestants." She says, "Let's give them the answer. Let them give them the questions." He says, "What are you talking about?" And she says, 5,080 feet." He says, "A mile. What's a mile?" And that's how it started. And I was able to put that in the book, and I felt so good about giving Julianne her just due. And the other one was one that really I Wikipedia'd and looked and checked and made sure it was right. It was the story Jack Parr told to me at Dinah Shore's house at a small dinner party. He asked me to come in the other room, and he was always a very nervous guy. He stuttered a lot. He was particularly nervous that night. He said, I have to tell you something. And he told me this story. And the story told me, I think it's entitled Castro, Cuba, and Castration, or Cuba, Castro, and Castration. And it's a true story. It's told to me by Parr. And I said, gee, I wonder, you know, how do I authenticate this? And I looked it up, and there it was. It actually happened, the castration, because Fulgencio Batista, who was the general in charge of Cuba before Castro took over, had actually done this. He had castrated people who had not obeyed his orders. And it was a true story. I mean, and I want to make sure. Oh, by the way, Parr actually put it in a biography he had written, and for some reason, I understand, that's what I was told, it was deleted from his memoir.
Wow.
So the only place it exists is in my memoir, and I'm very proud of the fact that Parr, when he told it to me, he said, you know, I don't think I'll ever sleep, I'll ever have a comfortable sleep again after I saw what
well,
I saw.
It is a remarkable story, and I'm glad that you put it in there because Parr's publisher took it out. But I do have to tell you, Carl, while I was reading about it in your book, I did cross my legs.
You know, I can't imagine what it looks like when he talks about 500 castrated men and 300 castrated in Oriente Province and Pinar del Rey. I remember those two so well because I smoked cigars that came from that area.
Wow. Let me go back to the Julianne Wright story and helping Merv create Jeopardy! I had not heard that story before I read it in your book, and what amazed me about it was that she never got credit for that. Why not?
You know, it's funny, and she doesn't like to talk about it because she has grandchildren with him, and she doesn't want to muddy his career. But when she wrote it, when she came up with the idea, she asked him, she said, shouldn't I be getting at least a created by? He said, there's no such credit. It's produced by, and I'm taking that credit. Well, when they got divorced and he sold it for $20 million, he never even called her and said, I think you should have some of this. That was to me, the worst.
Yeah.
The worst.
I mentioned all the awards and life achievement awards that you've gotten in your career. In the book, you tell a story about one that maybe you want to forget about, in which you went to a Golden Globe ceremony and you were the only winner who showed up. What year was that we're talking about?
I think it was, while I was doing the Van Dyke Show, so it had to be sometime in the 60s. And the Golden Globes in those days were, today they're precursor to the Oscar, but in those days it was sort of like a joke. There were two monocled Norwegians who were in charge of it, the Unger brothers, and it was sort of like a joke, and nobody ever showed up in those things. And they called me three times and said, I think you should show up. And I said, why? And they said, they had pre-knowledge that the Van Dyke Show had won an award. And Dick said, why don't you go? He says, publicity is better than open. I said, that's true, whatever. But when I was there, I realized, I says, my God, everybody who won an award wasn't there. There was somebody picking it up from, or the host said, we accept this award in the name of, and now it came to Mickey Rooney, and I thought Mickey Rooney was there because the little guy got up when his name was called, but it was a guy just going to the toilet who was short, and the next name was mine for the Dick Van Dyke. I said, oh, my God, and I remembered thinking on my feet. I said, what am I going to say? I'm so embarrassed, and I said, you know, I said, I'm terribly embarrassed, but I had a dinner appointment for tonight, and I wasn't going to be able to be here. And I asked Marlon Brando to pick up my award, and Marlon said he'd be pleased and thrilled to do it. And the last minute, he said he was called away, so I had to pick up my own award. And I just want to apologize to everybody for the fact that Marlon isn't here, and you have to see me picking up my award. I'm embarrassed, and thank you anyway. Anyway, that was. And I got a lot of laughs, I must say.
But that was a time when the Golden Globes were a joke in Hollywood, and now, of course, that's all changed.
Oh, now it's they're run quite a bit differently.
You and I have talked a lot over the years about the Dick Van Dyke Show, and there's been a lot of talk recently about people who are showrunners, like Matthew Weiner at Mad Men, and Chuck Lorre at The Big Bang Theory, yes. And Two and a Half Men, which you worked on. A lot of them started as writers. You started as a performer / writer. How important is it to have a writer at the helm of a TV show?
Well, there's no question about it that the word is what we're listening to, the word on the page. And only the great comedians can do ad-lib shows, but we have situation comedy actors, and Dick Van Dyke being the very best that ever lived. They come up with things and attitudes, and all great comedians do, but the word has to be there for them to change or even add to. And, one of the things that I get most thrilled about is being stopped by young writers in their 30s and 40s who said, you know, I'm a writer because of the Dick Van Dyke Show. There were young kids who watched the show and always thought comedians made up their own jokes. They never knew they were writers. And these were kids who were funny but never thought of standing up. They were too shy. And they said, now I know what I can do. I can write for comedians. And not one dozen, two dozen, but three or four dozen people have come up to me through the years and say, I'm a writer because I found out there was such a thing as television writers for comedy on the Dick Van Dyke Show. We found that out.
Yeah, but I bet that they don't do what you did, which was before the show goes on the air, write the full season.
Yeah, well, what happened is when I finished doing your show of shows, I was offered situation comedies. And they weren't very well written, and my wife said, why don't you write one? I've told this before, and I said, I remember exactly the moment I said, what am I going to write about? I was on the East Side Drive at the Franklin Delano Roosevelt, getting off a ramp, and I said, 96th Street, and I said, I actually talked to myself. I recommend talking to yourself. If you're smart, you'll get a smart answer. So I asked a smart question. I said, what piece of ground do I stand on that nobody else stands on? I said, even twins stand on different ground. One's looking out the window, one's looking at a picture of his uncle on a wall. And I said, well, I live in New Rochelle. I have a wife and kids. I work in New York on a variety show, The Review. I said, I'll write about that, my life in New Rochelle. When I go to the office, I'll talk about my family life. When I go to home, I'll talk about my days in the office. And I wrote a thing called Head of the Family. And I said, well, if I'm going to do it, I better have a Bible. So I wrote 13 episodes one summer. Every three, 4 days, I popped one out of the typewriter. And I did the pilot with Morty Gunty and Sylvia Miles. And it wasn't very good. So I put it aside. And I started writing. I wrote a movie for Doris Day, The Thrill of It All. But my agent, Harry Calstram, had these 13 scripts on his desk, and it bothered him that they were going nowhere. So he called Sheldon Leonard, who, along with Danny Thomas, had a thing called T&L Productions, Thomas and Leonard Productions. They said, we'd like your show. We read your show. And I told Sheldon, I said, you know, I did a pilot, and I don't want to go to bat and fail the second time with the same show. And I remember this, Sheldon, this is a good impression of him, by the way. He says, Con, you won't fail because we'll get a better actor to play you. And he suggested Dick Van Dyke, and the best actor that ever worked in television.
And you write a little bit about that in your books. And in the most recent one, you actually talk about how much of your career now appears online on things like YouTube. In fact, at one point you joke, it should be called MeTube. There's so much of me.
Yeah, one
on
day
there.
I decided, I was looking for something I had done. I was trying to research something. I don't wonder what the name of that show was. And I asked what show it was, and up came 300. You know, it's funny. Somebody told me that Betty White was in the Guinness Book of Records as being the longest person in television, woman. And I realized I've been in television since 1947 when it first started at the ABC Theater. There was a horse rink there, and they had one studio for news, and we used that studio for a little show I did called The Fashion Story with Marilyn Day. I played a comic photographer. And from 1947 to today, I've been on. I was Googling the shows, and I found out I got game shows, and there were about 100 different shows I did, and I forgot some of those shows, and I said, I went to YouTube, and I said, YouTube is not anybody else's tube but my tube, because everything, my whole life passed in front of my eyes. It's not your tube, his tube, her tube, but it's my tube.
Does it bother you at all that all that stuff is available for free consumption, and you don't get royalties or residuals?
That's one of the things we want to do. We want to be remembered when we go. We don't want to get paid for being remembered. Now, it's nice that we send nice things out to the world. That makes you smile, something into the world that made somebody smile once.
You mentioned your show of shows, which you were on for so many years with the legendary Sid Caesar, who died just a couple of months ago at age 91. Tell me how you first met him.
Well, actually, I was in a show called Alive and Kicking, and Max Liebman, who was the producer of your show of shows, wanted somebody to be a straight man to Sid, and he invited me to come there. And that first day in the office is when I met Mel Brooks, by the way. And I didn't know who Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks wasn't working there. He was working for Sid, and he did a couple of things that made me roar with laughter. And for the next 10 years, Mel and I we created the 2,000-year-old men in that office just to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? Oh, yeah, but Sid was the comedian. I mean, he informed every sketch comedian that ever came after him. He was a genius, no question about his talent. There was nobody like him.
You and Mel still get together and have dinner together often and watch Jeopardy?
Almost six nights a week.
Wow. Through the years, as he's been doing his movie projects and you've been doing your many movie and TV projects, have you ever called him or has he ever called you and said, I am stuck here, help me?
No, as a matter of fact, when we started doing movies, we went our ways. He had a brand of humor that nobody has. I mean, I think they were celebrating the great comedy he did with, about the West.
Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
It's being celebrated this year. There's nobody like Mel. His comedies are cherished. And I did the different kind of comedies, light comedies, and during those years we didn't see much of each other.
Oh!
But our wives were very good friends, so we always met for dinner, and went out to movies together.
And I also want to ask you about another guy like you, a Mark Twain Prize for American Humor winner, who you did five movies with between 1979 and 1984, and that, of course, is Steve Martin. You helped him write and actually directed his very first movie called The Jerk. How do Carl Reiner and Steve Martin get together?
Well, because Steve had done, he'd been a rock star comedian. He'd been playing for venues of 46,000 people doing his act.
Yep.
And now he's into movies, but he never talked to another actor. He talked to the microphone and to people. So when they did this movie, they said he needed a director. They had written a very good version of it with a guy named Mike Elias and two other writers. And I was brought in. I did a little polish on the script, but I was there mainly to make it possible for Steve to talk to other people. But he took to it so fast. I mean, he's close to being genius. I mean, he is an amazing writer, by the way. I think his biography is one of the best biographies. Born Standing Up is one of the best biographies ever written.
I agree.
And he's written a book on art that is exquisite. He's an exquisite writer. Exquisite.
Yeah. So it wasn't hard to direct him?
Not at all. I mean, he directs himself. Give him a suggestion and he carries it further than you'll ever dream it's going to go.
In the book, I Just Remembered, your new memoir, you talk about your earliest days and all the way up to your most recent days. But you talk about the beginning of your show business really getting a boost from government programs under FDR.
Right.
What were those, and do things like that still exist?
Well, you know, it's funny. I get so angry at the people who say, get the government off your back. I said, I wouldn't be an actor if it wasn't for the government. During times where people need jobs, the government supplying jobs, there was a thing called WPA, the Works Progress Administration, where Franklin Roosevelt offered to people who needed help schooling. I went to a school, the WPA. It was called the workshop where they taught acting. My brother found a little ad saying free acting classes under WPA, 100 Center Street, New York. I was 17. I went there. Mrs. Whittington, an English actress, and there it was for me to learn to act on a stage. And it was, if it wasn't for the WPA and the NYA Radio Workshop, another government-sponsored program where I learned how to act on radio with Howard Morris in 19, by the way, the same building that Letterman is now coming out of. That was the building where the NYA was, and we did these programs for $23.50 a week. We did three or four programs, all kinds of announcing classical orchestras, shows and variety shows, and it was the government who paid us $22 a week at one point to learn our craft. They also paid for artists to paint who would be out of work. They did some of the greatest murals they still exist in all the post offices throughout the country. Musicians were paid to learn to conduct and play their instruments. It was a wonderful time, and so when I read about get the government off of people's back, I get so angry because that's what government is for. When people need help, the government is there to should be there to help that. And the Republicans drive me crazy.
The government had your back in those situations.
They sure did.
Yeah. Last thing I want to ask you about, which is probably a lie, because like Columbo and you, I'll think of something else after I say this is the last thing, but maybe this will be the last thing. We'll see. In the book, you have a picture of you having quail eggs for breakfast, hard-boiled quail eggs. I have never talked to any other human being who has eaten quail eggs, and I want to know why, and why don't you just eat chicken eggs?
I do, as a matter of fact, but I happen to be in a restaurant, and there was a little Japanese counter, and they had these little boxes of quail eggs. I said, what do you do with these? I took them home. They look so cute. I boiled them, I shelled them, I sliced them on my slicer, and I put them on a piece of bread. It looked so cute. And when you bit into them, every time you bit into them, you got a perfect... Oh, by the way, I also fried a dozen quail eggs and had the cutest omelet with little eyes looking at 12 eyes looking at it. It was just so cute. I thought I had to take a picture of it. I only did it once or twice, but they looked so cute. And by the way, the bite into that white bread with those quail eggs there, every bite was a delight.
You get an egg in every bite.
Yes, a delight in every bite.
I think I saw you tweet about that on Twitter sometime.
I probably did.
All right, I did think of one last question for you. Years and years, and I mean years ago, Carl, because we have talked many, many times. In fact, it's been 20 years since my then-pregnant wife sat on your lap while you autographed one of your books to me at a book signing that I hosted for you in 1994.
Oh, wow.
But back many, many years ago, we talked about poker. And you jokingly at one point actually invited, you'll have to come to my poker game sometime, which I knew you were joking, and I didn't show up on your doorstep and say, I'm here. But I wonder if you still play, because in the old days you were playing with Steve Martin and Chevy Chase and Johnny Carson and the others. Do you still have a poker game?
No, the poker game disappeared when some of the people passed on. Johnny Carson was, he loved that poker game. No, Johnny Carson was a great sleight of hand artist, and so was Steve. But they never cheated at poker. they showed us their moves because they really were great sleight of hand artists.
You'd never be in the middle of a hand and they'd say, Carl, is this the card you need? And pull it out of their sleeve?
No, they didn't do that.
Well, congratulations on yet another book. It's called I Just Remembered, the latest in a series of memoirs, because you keep coming up with new ones, and it's available now in book form, in iBook, in eBook.
One of my favorite things about that book is the back cover, where people usually get quips from authors.
Yep.
And I wish I had it in front of me. I'd read it because it's worth a laugh, but I don't have it with me. So
it's full of wonderful, wonderful stories, and it's really always a pleasure to talk to you. And I look forward to doing it again next year for the next book.
I will. You may sit on my lap and we'll do it.
Carl Reiner, recorded earlier today. His new book is available in every format right now. It's called I Just Remembered. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.